I'm going to shorten my message if I can here, because we're running out of time quickly. But I think I can give you more of a condensed version of Genesis. We're in chapter 49, talking about, this is the point in time where Jacob decides to go back home. He says, send me on my way so I can go back to my own homeland, giving my wives and children for whom I have served, and I will be on my way. You know how much work I've done for you. He's talking to Laban, by the way. But Laban said to him, if I found favor in your eyes, please stay. I have learned by divination that the Lord has blessed you because of me. And that's just something that the world can see. They can see the blessings of God on God's children. So he said, he added, name your wages and I'll pay them. And then Jacob said to him, you know how I've worked for you and how your livestock has fared under me. The little you had before I came has increased greatly. And the Lord has blessed you wherever I have been. But now, when may I do something for my own household? What shall I give you? Laban said. Don't give me anything, Jacob replied. But if you will do this one thing for me, I will go on tending your flocks and watching over them. Let me go through all your flocks today and remove from them every speckled or spotted sheep, every dark-colored lamb, and every spotted or speckled goat. That would be the inferior animals. They will be my wages, and my honesty will testify me for me in the future. I said 49. Is that right? Did I write it down wrong? No. It was. Somebody help me. Was it 29? I'm almost done reading anyway. You can just listen. It was a typo. I had typed in 49. That might be 29. Anyway, whenever you check on my wages, you have paid me. Any goat in my possession that is not speckled or spotted, or any lamb that's not dark-colored, will be considered stolen. Agreed, said Laban. Let it be as you have said. At this point, these two guys, who were both pretty good con men, settled on an agreement. Laban thought it was a good deal because he's getting labor for inferior animals. Jacob thought it was a pretty good idea because he had a plan in his mind. Now we'll go on with the plan. That same day, Jacob removed all the male goats that were streaked or spotted, placed them in the care of his sons, and then he put a three-day journey between himself and Jacob, while Jacob continued to tend the rest of Laban's flocks. Jacob, however, took fresh-cut branches. Here's his plan. Fresh-cut branches from poplar, almond, and plane trees and made white strips on them by peeling the bark and exposing the white inner wood on the branches. Then he placed the peeled branches in the watering trough so that they would be directly in front of the flocks when they came to drink. When the flocks were in heat and came to drink, they mated in front of the branches, and they bore young that were streaked or speckled or spotted. And Jacob set apart the young of the flock by themselves, but made the rest face the streaked and dark-colored animals that belonged to Laban. Thus he made separate flocks for himself and did not put them with Laban's animals. Whenever the stronger females were in heat, Jacob would place the branches in the troughs in front of the animals so they would mate near the branches. But if the animals were weak, he would not place them there. So the weak animals went to Laban and the strong ones to Jacob. In this way, the man grew exceedingly prosperous and came to own large flocks and female and male servants and camels and donkeys. So Jacob's got this plan. He uses these branches. And my question for you is, do you think him putting the branches in the troughs had anything to do with him getting the larger herds of animals, stronger herds, more valuable herds? No, I hear no. It can't. I mean, we know enough about biology today to know that that's not what causes the streaks and the spots. So I look at this, we look at this, and we say, Jacob, you know, you're not as smart as we are today. You're kind of silly. This is kind of silly. It doesn't work that way. But in reality, if you look at it a little bit closer, don't we find ourselves doing the same thing today as Jacob's doing? You see, what do you mean? Well, give you a couple of examples. When Joseph was wrestling, loved that time, him and Stephen and Daniel. I happened to notice one time that while the match was going on the wrestling mat, in the very corner of the wrestling mat, there was a little Hot Wheels car sitting there. Do you know about this, Joanne?
No, I just know how they have to pick things up, or they have to do
something. And I thought,
yeah, I know there's little things.
What's the Hot Wheel car doing on the mat? So, I mean, it was there for the whole match. And at one point, I walked over. I was kind of standing behind the mat. And I walked over, and I took my foot, and I kind of kicked it off the mat. I didn't want somebody stepping on it and whatever. I heard this voice say, "What are you doing?" It was the coach. I said, "I was just getting the Hot Wheel." He said, "Go get that, put that back on there." So I went and got the Hot Wheel and put it back on there. I didn't know why or anything. He just wanted it there. Well, I talked to Joseph later on. And Joseph said, he thinks that brings him luck. If that Hot Wheel car is on the mat, he thinks it'll bring him luck. Well, that's silly, isn't it? But it was always there. And then I noticed one time, I'm watching football on TV, and I don't know if you remember George Seifert. He used to be the coach of the 49ers. He's, before the game, they're doing their warm-ups, and it shows him unwrapping a pack of lifesavers. He takes the lifesaver out, holds it up, blows through the hole and eats it, puts it in his mouth. And the announcer on TV says, "You know, he always blows through the lifesaver before he puts it in his mouth." It turns out that he's superstitious. He thinks that if he doesn't blow through the hole in the lifesaver, his team's not going to win the game. Now, he really believes that, enough so that he does it every time. So how different are we today than Jacob was? When the kids were smaller and we were in Florida, I sat down one time to watch TV, and on the TV was one of these darts. You know, the kind that you punch in the gun, and they got a little suction cup on the end. And there's this dart on the TV, and I thought, what's a dart doing on the TV? So I took it off and threw it away or whatever, and a few days later, I look up, and there's another dart on the TV again. So that's strange, twice, and kids are must be having these little war games, you know, and they're shooting and hitting the TV or whatever. So took the dart off the TV for the second time. And I think that was a Sunday, and was getting ready to watch TV. And so I was going to watch a football game. So I turned on the TV, and Joseph comes walking in the room. Now, at this time, he's maybe 8 or 10 years old. And he says, "Where's my lucky dart?" I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "The dart I had on TV." I said, "I took it off. What are you putting it on the TV for?" He said, "I need that dart on there. The Dolphins aren't going to win their game." I said, "Really?" So he went and looked for his dart and stuck it back on the TV. I didn't say anything about it. But these little things, and we probably, if you look in your life, you probably got your own little things that you do that are, you know, somewhat superstitious or whatever. But there is a problem with that. This shows we're really not that different than Jacob. Jacob thought this would make the sheep and lambs work their way into his fold. But it doesn't work that way, but we think it does. But what's the danger of it? Is there a danger of this of doing these types of things? I think there is. And here's the danger. Just as leaving the little car on the wrestling mat or putting the lucky dart on TV or blowing through the lifesaver, just as, well, let's take one of them. Let's take the lucky dart. Just as leaving the lucky dart on the TV and then the Dolphins winning, what that does is, in a sense, it robs the Dolphins of the glory of their victory. It puts the credit on the dart, right? And it's the same with the little car on the mat. It takes some of the glory away from the wrestler who's practiced and worked and cut weight and did all the hard work and wins the mat, and the coach turns around and claps for the little car. You know, it takes some of the glory away if you look at it from the big picture standpoint. That is the danger. So let's go back to Jacob. What is the danger of Jacob putting the peeled strips of bark in the trough? It takes away a little bit of the glory to God. It was God who was building up his flocks. Now, we'll see later on in the scripture, God had told Jacob, when he asks you for your wages, you tell him you want the streaked and the spotted lambs and the goats. So God had this plan already. And Jacob knew it. That's why he asked for these things. But what did Jacob do? He got his fingerprints on the situation. He created something that diverted the glory from God to himself, to his ingenuity of setting up the streaks and the branches. And that is the danger of why we should not be superstitious. We should not do things because it takes away from the blessings that God has given us, the glory that belongs to God and to God alone. The very first commandment that God gives us. I am the Lord your God. You shall have no other gods before me. When you peel the branches, when you put the car on the mat, when you put the lucky dart on the TV, in a small way, and I'm not saying this is anything big, I'm saying it's small, but in a small way, you are taking the glory from where the glory belongs. And Jacob, in a small way, took the glory from God and placed it upon himself. God is serious about wanting to receive the glory himself and not have any other, for us to worship any other gods. After all, what is the second commandment? The second commandment says, you shall not make any graven images. In other words, you shall not make any idols. And the reason I believe those two commandments are first and second is, number one, that's the priority. God said, this is most important, that you honor me above and beyond anything else, above your parents, above the rest of the commandments, because he knew that if you did not do commandment number one, you would automatically break commandment number two. Because what happens when you don't, when you place any other god in front of God, that god eventually turns into an idol. And that's the whole problem with the Hebrew people throughout their whole history, up until the time they were taken to Babylon. They started making idols. And they made idols because they allowed other gods to come in more preeminence than God, Jehovah God. So that's the danger. It starts out as something small. It then leads to idol worship. And idol worship, in turn, turns our hearts away from God. So it turns into a form of idolatry. What does God want us to do? He wants us to have him first and foremost, because he knows that that's the way the system's supposed to work. It's not because he's egotistical. He knows how he made us, and he knows that if it doesn't go that way, we will make idols, our hearts will turn from him, and we will have a disastrous future like the Israelites did. So there's just a little devotional, I guess you would call it. I want to stop there because I want to spend the last couple of minutes talking about our final hymn that we're going to have today. Number 356 is going to be Eternal Father Strong to Save. I got this email from Dave this week. There's a story behind this song, and I think it fits into Veterans Day, and I wanted to read you the part about the story, because as you sing the song, I think it'll mean more to you knowing the story. The hymn's author was an Anglican churchman named William Whiting, who was born in England in 1825. As a child, he dodged in and out of the waves as they crashed along England's shoreline. But years later, on a journey by sea, Whiting learned the true and terrifying power of these waves. A powerful storm blew in, so violent that the crew lost control of the vessel. During these desperate hours, as the waves roared over the decks, Whiting's faith in God helped him to stay calm. And when the storm subsided, the ship, badly damaged, limped back to port. The experience had a galvanizing effect on Whiting. As one hymn historian put it, Whiting was changed by this experience. He respected the power of the ocean nearly as much as he respected the God who made it and controls it. The memory of this voyage allowed Whiting to provide comfort to one of the boys he taught at a training school in Winchester. One day a young man confided that he was about to embark on a journey to America, a voyage fraught with danger at that time. The boy was filled with dread at the thought of the ordeal to come. A sympathetic whiting described his own frightening experience, and he told the other boys, and he and the other boys prayed for the terrified student. And then Whiting told him, "Before you depart, I will give you something to anchor your faith." Whiting, an experienced poet, put pen to paper and wrote a poem reminding the boys of God's power, even over the mighty oceans. And it begins like this: "Eternal Father, strong to save, whose arm hath bound the restless wave, who bids the mighty ocean deep its own appointed limits keep. Oh, hear us when we cry to thee for those in peril on the sea." That's the first verse of the song we're going to sing. Scholars believed Whiting was inspired by Psalm 107, and in verses 28 and 29, which say, "Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble, and he made the storm to be stilled and the waves of the sea to be hushed." Now, in 1861, Whiting's poem was set to music by Reverend John Dykes. The hymn became enormously popular. British, French, and American sailors all adopted it. Winston Churchill loved it, and the hymn was performed at the funerals of President Franklin Roosevelt, John Kennedy, and Richard Nixon. Over the years, those who have loved the hymn and the men and women it honors have written additional stanzas, verses that ask for God's protection over the Marines, the Seabees, the Submariners, the Flyers, the Coast Guard, and the Navy SEALs, and the Army. They ask God to remember the needs of wounded warriors, asking, "By power of thy breath, restore the ill and those with wounds of war." Touchingly, one new stanza also asks God's protection for families of those who serve, asking, "O Father, hear us when we pray for those we love so far away." Veterans Day is a reminder that we should be praying regularly for those who put themselves in harm's way and for their families and those who suffer in the after effects of combat. This has since become the hymn of the United States Navy. It's sung at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis. And today we're going to sing it for our closing hymn. And the words should recall to our minds the fact that none of us will escape the storms and tempests of life. And its words will offer comfort and help us anchor our faith, as William Whiting put it, when the winds and the waves of our own lives threaten to capsize us. So, Bud, if you'll come up at this time, we will do our closing hymn, "Eternal Father, Strong to Save," and dedicate this to our veterans today.
Stand, please.